Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. I'm your host, John Williamson, and we're back for the last of the re-release series, and here's your Halloween treat. This is one that we put out many years ago, and I remember Adam and I did this one, and it's like, this one's a tough one because, you know, this is kind of one of our more controversial episodes probably that we did just because of, you know, where people stand on kind of the unseen world in regards to spirits and angels and devils and demons and things of that nature. So still not sure where I stand on that. But as Adam and I said when we finished recording it, there's something that's profoundly terrifying about someone who, you know, does believe in those things and wholeheartedly believes that these things are true and has experienced things that they feel are, you know, stem from some sort of demonic unseen realm. So it's it was pretty spooky, but interesting nonetheless. So take it as you will. It's at the very least a fun kind of topical Halloween themed episode. So this is one we did with Father Gary Thomas, who's an incredibly kind individual and was kind enough to be a guest on our show so many years ago. But he has a fascinating story. So he not only is a Catholic priest from out on the West Coast, but he is raised in San Francisco and is a longtime pastor in the Diocese of San Jose. In 2005, though, he was selected by his bishop to attend a Vatican-sponsored course on exorcism. So he is one of the few Vatican-certified practicing exorcists. There's, I believe, one also in the Indianapolis area, probably a little closer to us. But Father Thomas, his story is that much more interesting because there's a movie based on a book based on his life. And so the book is called The Rite, The Making of a Modern Exorcist, came out in 2009. They made a movie about it starring Sir Anthony Hopkins. And it's, obviously they took some artistic liberties with the film and we talk about that in the interview, a little bit, but, fascinating story, fascinating individual, and, kind of an interesting thing all around. So take it as you will. Some folks listening are like, you know, poppycock. And some are like, you know, it's possible. So who knows, right? But at the very least, we thought it was an interesting Halloween topic to cover. And so here we are, Halloween week. You're welcome. For all things deconstructionist, www.thedeconstructionist.com. You can listen to our entire back catalog of episodes. In fact, at the end of this month, now that you've listened to potentially all five of the re-release episodes of some of our greatest hits, you can go all the way back to the beginning and check out our first interview with Dr. Timothy Mackey or any of the other episodes that we did way back in the day. And so we covered a lot of topics, covered a lot of ground, talked to a lot of fascinating guests. So half the time I forget even who we've spoken to over the years, over these last 7 years. And it's quite incredible that we were fortunate enough and lucky enough, to be able to interview some of these guests. So, you know, that is not lost on us for sure. So you can go back all the way to the beginning of our archive of episodes on the website. You can stream them right through there if you want. You can also check out our blog, which is in dire need of updating. I promise you I'm working on several things that I will post in the very near future. Once life calms down a little bit, but, you can also link to us on social media. You can find our web store on there. So if you want a deconstructionist pint glass, it makes your beer taste better, or iced tea, whichever, you can find those on there. We got coffee mugs, t-shirts, all that jazz. Otherwise, subscribe, rate, and review. That's important. Helps people find us. And word of mouth is is basically our bread and butter. We are an independent podcast, not affiliated with a network. And so, you know, we work hard for every listener that we have. And really the vast majority of our listeners are based on word of mouth, based on you guys telling other people, hey, we think what they're doing is meaningful and worthwhile. Check it out. And so I appreciate each and every one of you who have passed this along to someone else. So many, many thanks. And starting in a couple weeks, I will be releasing brand new content. So finally, back to some new stuff. And so I've got some really cool topics I can't wait to cover. with you guys. So more to come in a couple of weeks, starting in November and December. We'll finish off the year, believe it or not. And then I'll be taking my usual month or two off at the beginning of the year just to stockpile episodes and get things rolling. But excited about some of the guests I'm talking to right now and in the process of setting up those interviews. So thank you guys so much for listening. Hopefully you enjoyed this re-release series, I guess we'll call it, during the month of October. And if you did like it, something that, you know, hopefully, you know, I'll do again in the future, pull out some even more old episodes. So, you know, some of you who are newer listeners can check them out. So, also on the horizon, we've been getting requests to do, we did a long time ago, we did a recommended reading, episode, just a shorty. And so talking to Adam about that right now, yes, we are still friends. He's just a busy boy. So he and I have been talking about, some of the stuff that we've been reading. And, so we'll put together something as far as that goes and put that out in the near future as well. So, all right, let's get to it. Spooky, spooky. Father Gary Thomas, here you go. Happy Halloween. Do you believe in love? 'Cause I'm alone. Do you believe in hell? 'Cause I am helpless. This water I am treading.
Yeah, non-denominational, I mean, mainly. Little bit of Lutheran.
That's fine. The ministry of exorcism would be a service. It would be a service within the church. So I don't mean by that a church service, but I mean by that a pastoral service.
Right.
It's okay. A form of pastoral care. So that's why I asked you what your backgrounds were, because at least we can kind of talk a common language. Because all Christians and all Christian churches would use the word ministry, just about all would use the word ministry as a way of expressing the kind of care that the church tries to provide for our people. And so, yes, I'm a full-time priest, that kind of is an oxymoron. As a priest, in the Catholic sense, you know, that it's sort of like there's 31 flavors. So, you know, there's lots of ways that priests serve in the church, and I happen to be what we would call a diocesan priest, which means that I'm basically a parish priest. So I serve in a parish, but there's other ministries that priests who are parish priests can also be involved in. I mean, some can teach in high schools. They don't have to necessarily be part of a religious order, although usually all of these sort of specialized ministries, more often than not, are done by religious orders. In the ministry of exorcism, usually, but not limited to, because I have plenty of examples of guys who are in religious orders and who do this too. It's usually a priest. It's always a priest selected by the bishop, whether he be attached to a religious order or he's a priest of a local diocese, who serves at the pleasure of the bishop and either can be designated on a case-by-case basis or can be what's it called mandated. I happen to be mandated. And so... But it is a ministry. It's a recognized ministry within the church. It's been part of the church since the time of Jesus.
Wow.
Who performed exorcisms himself. And
right.
That's in the scriptures.
So we kind of just jumped in, but for those of our listeners who aren't familiar, we are speaking with Father Gary Thomas. You were located in California, and so how many? Because my understanding was, as of 2011, there were only around 14. Exorcists, you know, sanctioned by the Catholic Church. Is that still a relatively low number, or has it increased since then?
Oh no, it's increased. It's increased exponentially, really, since the movie.
Oh wow!
But I think the movie did move the needle. But I also think more and more bishops are facing more and more people who are calling for either an investigation into their personal struggles, in which they would require an exorcist, or that they think they require an exorcist, because there's a discernment process that's always a part of, you know, this. So when I get a call and someone says to me, which is often the case, I need an exorcism. I don't do them on request. That doesn't happen that way. That may not be what they need. There's a whole discernment process, and it's fairly involved. I mean, you know, I don't even meet any longer. I'm not usually the first contact. My team is, although I get lots of calls because I just don't have the time. I mean, I could have 10 calls a week often.
Wow. So,
and the team, I have a team of 7 people who are my prayer team, and they take the calls and they do basically the kind of the vetting in terms of, you know, how do we approach this person? Now, because of the movie and the book, I get emails from all over the world and phone calls from all over the world too. And so what we try and do is direct people back to their local bishop, regardless of whatever part of the United States they live in. I usually don't take calls from outside the United States. I get them, but I mean, the cost of returning somebody's phone calls is enormous because I have, and then you end up getting, you know, paying a tremendous amount of money for a phone call that might last 5 minutes, and it's, you know, you're to Bangladesh or somewhere. So yeah. I mean, emails I'll respond to. Absolutely. I respond to all the emails.
Father Thomas, just for the record, which movie and book were you talking about, just so our listeners know?
Sorry. The movie, pardon me, the book is entitled The Rite, R-I-T-E. It was published in 2009. The author is Matt Ballio, who then later wrote the book Argo that went with the movie Argo.
Oh.
But his first book was The Rite. And I met Matt when I took the course on exorcism at the Regina Apostolorum Seminary in Rome when I was on my sabbatical back in 2005, 2006. And he was taking the course. He's married. He has a little boy. Well, actually, his son is no longer a little boy. He's probably a teenager now. He met his wife in Rome. He grew up in California, went to University of California, Santa Barbara, grew up in San Diego. And I met him at the course, and we became friendly acquaintances initially. And then eventually, when it was very, very clear, I really needed to find a mentor or a teacher under whom to train while this course was going on and beyond, that Matt asked, because he was a freelance journalist by profession, if he could write a book about my experiences. And I said in a very kind of casual way, sure, go ahead. I had no idea the book would become, you know, a very well-known book, and that Warner Brothers would then buy the rights to the book and make a movie out of it with the same title. And the star in the movie is Anthony Hopkins. And I worked on the movie for a week with Anthony Hopkins back in 2010. Then the movie was released in 2011.
I saw that movie in the theater with my brother-in-law.
Yep.
Oh,
and
that movie's about me.
When John told me that, because John set this interview up, I was so excited to tell my brother-in-law and now everybody that we get to speak with you because this is so fascinating.
Well, I think from an objective point of view, I mean, not everything in that movie is true in and of itself. So in other words, not everything in that movie happened to me, but there isn't anything in that movie that couldn't legitimately happen.
Oh,
I mean,
gosh.
My character was portrayed not by Anthony Hopkins. He was my mentor. The young priest was me, although I was not on the way out of the church. I hadn't lost my faith. I was ordained 22 years in real life. So, you know, I always tell people the movie's a movie. But I've given lots of talks. When the movie was released, I was down in Hollywood at the red carpet with Tony Hopkins and the crew and my mom and dad and siblings. And, you know, it's kind of like, I can't believe this is actually happening. But you also, you know, it's what's important to keep in mind is that it's a movie. And also, you know, my ego is not so, you know, inflated that I don't recognize that in real life, you know, everyone who comes to see me is suffering. And that's, you know, Christ is the exorcist, not me. And so I've never lost sight of that. So, you know, I just never got like overly impressed with the movie. I mean, I thought, well, it's a great opportunity to evangelize people. But I just never let it go to my head. None of that stuff ever did. Because honestly, when you're in the trenches and you're involved in an exorcism or a deliverance, you know, and you've got the person in front of you, the suffering is palpable, and sometimes the preternatural activity is right in front of you, it makes everything else you do pale, because you know you're in major combat with Satan or one of his or a group of his agents, and it's very sobering. And a lot of people think this is all kind of, you know, medieval and superstitious, and it's all kind of made up, and it's not. None of it is. I never doubted there was a Satan. I had just never, ever seen what I see now until I actually went to Rome and then found Father Carmen to work under and then began observing, you know, exorcisms and deliverances with him and seeing the same kinds of manifestations in person after person and realizing, okay, this must be real.
So one of the things you mentioned at the very beginning is you said that there, you know, you have a team that kind of takes a look at the person first, and I've noticed that in other interviews you've talked about the fact that there are there's a whole array of different tests, medical, psychological, that they have to go through in order to rule out, you know, a lot of other things. So maybe you could talk about that a little bit, and also there are also I've read I think, if I remember correctly, 6 classic signs that they have to kind of meet in order to fulfill, you know, the requirements that they would need to be eligible.
Well, let me answer the second question first, then I'll answer the first one. It does not require, the protocol in the Roman Catholic tradition does not require that all 6 signs must be manifested in order for an exorcism to happen. You actually only need 1. And so it's rare that I would see all 6 signs. But there are 6 classic signs of a demonic condition. And I like to use the word condition as opposed to possession, because not every person who comes, in fact, it's rare that a person would come and they are suffering from basically a complete demonic possession. That means in our world, whereby a demon, or much more accurately, a tribe of demons, and that's what they're called, because there's never just one, there's a tribe. A tribe of demons has taken basically full control over the body of a human being. That does not mean that they're taking control of the soul. It just means they're taking control of the body. Most people who are full possessions have a very, very difficult time functioning, even at a basic level. And I've encountered that a few times. The majority, however, where there is a demonic condition, as I refer to them as a condition rather than using the technical terms, because for exorcists, the word obsession and oppression don't always mean the same thing. So for me, an oppression refers to a kind of depression, and an obsession has characteristics of what we would say would be psychotic hallucinations, visual or auditory. And so you have to sort all that stuff out. Now, there is a 4th level, and it's called integration. And integration means where the person has chosen to accept the demon. Those people don't usually come to see me. Or if they do come to see me, and I had one recently come and see me, we're really in... they're in big trouble, because not only have they crossed the line, they basically now want to sever the relationship between the demonic and themselves. And Satan is like the mafia. He's, you know, once you're in, you can't get out, or it's very difficult to get out. And so usually the people that come to see me, if there is something of a demonic condition present, it's usually of a kind whereby they can function. They can have a family, raise their kids, have a job, drive their car. It's just that when they're in the presence of the holy, such as a church or even a priest or some other example of holiness, that they get sick, or they have very, very strong adverse reactions. Wow. And that can be a sign. It is usually a sign of a demonic problem. So, but you have to discern all that. So, and even in the forward of the ritual of the psalm rite of exorcism, it's very clear in there. The exorcist must consult experts in other fields. So on my team, I have the prayer team, which is one team. Then I have a team of professionals. I have a medical doctor. I have two clinical psychologists. One is bilingual. I have two psychiatrists. One is bilingual. They're actually both bilingual. And then there are times when I've got to go find somebody who knows something about certain kind of drugs, like a toxicologist, or sometimes if people have been abused, they can easily become dissociative, which means they have multiple personalities. You have to know who to go talk to about those things, because sometimes it can happen whereby a person may have what we call the dissociative disorder, where they may have altered personalities. And an altered personality is not a demon or a spirit. An altered personality is basically a shattered portion of the person's whole person that is trying to cope with the trauma of sexual abuse most of the time. Wow. So you've got to be able to sort all those things out. So that's why I have somebody who specializes in dissociative disorders. And, you know, and you got to know, you basically need to know a little about a lot. It's very entrepreneurial. I mean, it really truly is. You have to know a little about a lot.
Wow.
And that, but that's, you know, again, I'm not a therapist. So I need to go, okay, who do I know, or who might know someone who can put me in touch with somebody who deals with multiple personality disorders and help me figure out, am I dealing with a multiple or am I dealing with a demon? So everybody on the almost everybody on the team are all practicing Catholics. I mean, I prefer that because most therapists do not believe in anything spiritual. That's not to be judgmental of them. It's just a state of fact. Most therapists are atheists or agnostics. And so I have to have people who have a faith optic, because at least it has to be allowed that it be an option to consider in the discernment process of what is the root cause of the person's particular suffering as we understand it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I think one of the things that we'd love to hear your perspective on is just, you know, what is a demon? I mean, what do you guys, like, what's the, yeah, could you just explain a little bit, like when we talk about demonic
sure.
oppression or tribes of demons or, you know, yeah.
Sure. A demon is an angel that has chosen to follow the path that is in rebellion against God. Hmm. So when the rebellion in heaven, according to the 12th chapter of the book of Revelation, when the rebellion in heaven took place, a third of the angels, allegedly, a third of the angels, according to Scripture, joined Lucifer, the angel of light, in opposition to God over envy and jealousy of the human race. And that's what this is all about. And so demons do not lose their office, nor do they lose their nature. Their nature is spirit. Their office is angelic. In the same way, our nature as human beings is corporeal. Our office is human, but our nature is corporeal. In other words, we have bodies and spirits. We call our spirit our soul. As opposed to the angelic, they're pure spirits. So the angelic realm or the angelic nature is of a higher nature than the human nature. So angels have no bodies. They can travel faster than we can. They are far more intelligent and powerful than we are, and their sense of free will is far keener than ours is. That's why in the Scriptures, the demons can't be saved, because they knew in a very, very deeper, clearer, beyond a shadow of a doubt way that God is God, and that the Trinity predates creation. It's just that when God chose to become incarnate, there was always three persons in the Trinity. The Trinity was not an evolution. The Trinity is static in the fact of its structure. The Trinity, however, continues to evolve because God continues to evolve. You know, God is constant, but God is also evolving at the same time because of time and space. So God's love for us is unchangeable because God is the source of all creation. But God also evolves in that we learn more about God as we ourselves grow in our maturity of faith. And so therefore, when God, Jesus, when he comes, it's in response to humanity's fall from grace. It wasn't that God, the Father, sends the Son, who's not already in, It's not like the incarnation is an evolution. It's that the second person of the Trinity always was. God's decision to become incarnate happens as a result of the fall from grace. But it isn't like God the Creator dredged up the second person and then the Father and the Son together formed the Holy Spirit. It was already in place as the love of the Father and the Son, yes, create the Spirit, but it all was what didn't happen in response to the fall from grace. And so therefore the demonic operate in a community of chaos in the absolute opposite of how the angelic operate with Christ. They operate in a community of harmony because of their love for God. On the other hand, the demonic operate in a community of chaos because of their hatred for the human race and of God and their rebellion.
So one of the questions that I know some of our listeners will want me to ask, so we have a loving God, we have these rebellious angels. Why not, you know, from God's perspective, why not just cause these rebellious angels to cease to exist instead of allowing them the power and the opportunity to essentially, you know, dabble and mess with human beings, his creation?
In order that God provide us with a very clear choice as to whom we owe allegiance. Do we choose to give allegiance to God, or do we choose to give allegiance to the evil one? And so God gives Satan boundaries, and he allows Satan to operate within those boundaries throughout the course of time. At the end of the age, which we call the parousia in the Greek, meaning the end times, the end of the world, Satan and his and the demonic will be destroyed. But until such time, they operate within boundaries. And they operate within boundaries for God's greater glory, basically, as well as to give human beings a very clear path and choice in terms of the direction they want to live their lives in.
So I think this is the perfect time to get into, so what factors contribute to a person potentially becoming possessed?
That's a good question.
Well, when people come in and seek our counsel and assistance, we're always listening in the interviews. We're always listening for doorways. So a person really has, I would say, the vast majority of cases of people whom I serve are people who basically have gotten the attention of a demon because they've conjured the demonic or the spiritual through artificial devices. And so, you know, the occult is all about power and knowledge. We live in a time now when classic religion not just Christianity, but I think classic religion in general is on a great big steep decline. And a lot of it is, and certainly Christianity specifically, is because of the fact that people want what they want, and they want it now. You know, the economy of prayer is too much effort and time and trouble. They want what they want now. The occult gives people what they want now, but you pay a big price for it. You pay a big price for it because once you start dabbling in, you know, witchcraft, magic, sorcery, crystals, Ouija boards, tarot card readings, seeking psychics, you are opening doors to the spirit world. And it's the side of the spirit world that is not necessarily godly. In fact, it's mostly anti-godly. And it's anti-godly because it's a cheap imitation of, you know, being able to move outside of the material world. And so when we meet with people, we ask them those kinds of questions. I mean, we ask questions about their upbringing too. You know, what was it like growing up in your home? Tell me about your relationship with your father or your mother. Any history of addictions, drugs, alcohol, pornography. Pornography is a doorway. Drugs can be a doorway. If they've had any history with the occult, we need to know about those things. And very often there is. There has been prior activity and maybe activity that has even been going on up to the time they come to see us. So I would say the majority of people, they've basically waved the flag saying, I'm interested. And the interest really comes in the implication of, you know, using conjuring devices or other means, rituals, and other means to tap into this, that part of the spirit world. Now, there are times when people can have a spell put on them without their knowledge or without their will involved. And very often, if a person has not been living, you know, a life of godliness, sometimes those spells can actually take hold. The effects of them can take hold. Or if a child in the womb is exposed to the occult, usually by the mother of the child in the womb, who either seeks a tie with a witch doctor, or they themselves are involved in the practice of the occult or Satanism. You know, fetuses are very vulnerable to the demonic, and fetuses can be they can suffer from a demonic condition very, very early before they're born, and that has sometimes been the case. And you have to ask all those questions when you sit with someone. And then if you see signs in the course of prayer, which you pray with people, they call them deliverance prayer, which is in a sense also part of the diagnostic, then you know that there is something of a preternatural presence that's there.
So we kind of alluded to this earlier, but there are six signs that you look for, right? And so what, if you could go over some, you know, the signs that you're kind of looking for when you're...
Sure.
Yeah.
An aversion to the sacred. In other words, you know, a question that would come up would be, you know, let's just say they're Catholic. Most people who come to me are Catholic, but Satan does not limit himself to Catholics. But most people who come are. So if a person has been involved in, say, the practice of witchcraft for 5 years, and has been involved in, you know, performing spells or gotten people to perform spells on others, usually for, it's either for one of two reasons, it's either for retaliation or manipulation. And then they themselves begin to show symptoms of illness when they go to Mass, or when it comes time to receive the Eucharist, there is a very strong pungent odor emitted from the consecrated host, or during the reception of the Eucharist, when you swallow the true body and blood of our Lord Jesus, there's great pain in the swallowing down through one's esophagus. Or you go to mass, you go to a church, even a Christian church, not necessarily even a Catholic church, and you become ill because you walk in and you feel this sense of fear for no apparent reason. That's one sign. Another sign would be during deliverance prayer, the demon exhibits incredible and inordinate amounts of physical strength that the person doesn't normally possess. That's another one. Another one would be where they begin speaking in a language they don't have any competency in. That usually occurs during deliverance prayer or rite of exorcism. Another would be the demon is able to articulate knowledge of hidden things that the person himself would not know about, either me or the team or something else. Another sign would be foaming at the mouth, where there would be the expulsion of large ball-like globs of sputum that the person would cough up during prayer. It isn't like shaving cream foam, but it is very distinct in its expulsion, not only because of its color, but also because of the length of time that the person might endure in coughing up all of this mucus. But it's a sign of casting. It's actually a good thing. And then the last sign would be epileptic-like seizures that take place during prayer or during the presence of in the presence of the Holy, where a person's face will distort, their limbs will be out of control, they might fall on the floor and begin to manipulate their tongue like something you'd see in a snake, you know, an animal planet. So those are the six signs.
Just garden variety stuff, you know.
Yeesh.
Man. So I would love, and, you know, I think our listeners would definitely be intrigued. Obviously, you know, some things about your ministry have been recorded in book form and even in film form, but just, you know, for us here, if you can, would you be willing to maybe talk about a case that you remember that, you know, expanded your whole awareness of what was going on? So, you know, you walk in believing one thing, and after the case is over, you go, oh man, it's more, it's bigger, this shocked me, this surprised me. You remember anything like that you'd care to share with us?
As you were, you know, and I've been asked that question lots of times. One amongst many took place a few years ago when a man was brought to me from another diocese, actually, because they had no exorcist in this particular diocese, and it's not too far from here. And the person had actually manifested at the Easter Vigil in the cathedral at the feet of the bishop. And they had no exorcist. So I was called, and the person came with family. And, you know, what really took place were these ferocious manifestations during prayer. That was the result of the person being exposed to the demonic in the womb, whereby the father of this man did not believe that his wife was carrying his child. He was suspicious that his wife was carrying the child of someone else. So he started performing acts of witchcraft on his wife, and she in turn began retaliating by doing the same thing. When the child himself was two, he was molested by a half-brother and a cousin. And so that provided the doorway for the demonic to come in. So that the child was already exposed to the witchcraft, but it was the abuse that provided, in a sense, the engine to usher in the presence of the demonic. And so this guy, for years felt that there was something tied to him, but he always thought it was his guardian angel. He always felt there was something attached. But it wasn't until he was 35 that the demonic was threatened enough sufficiently in the cathedral and exposed, basically manifested. And it caused this guy tremendous hardship. And so we worked with him for about 4 years. And we finally concluded our time with him because he was at that time unwilling to continue certain disciplines that were required, such as worship every week and confession every month. Later, he sought out the help of an exorcist who was then appointed at this same diocese. And that exorcist, who's a personal friend of mine, was actually able to finally and fully deliver him from the clutches of Satan.
Wow. So I wonder if you could, just for a moment, because you use the term manifested several times. What exactly does that mean in the context of the situation?
A manifestation would be the display of a reaction to prayer. That is, that would be considered abnormal. So during prayer, where the person begins to roll their eyes or begins to foam at the mouth or begins to curse and swear in a language they have no competency in, that's what I mean by manifestation. It's a physical reaction to the power of prayer. That is, in a sense, a perversion of how prayer should, it's a perversion of the effect that prayer should have on a person. So if a person is not afflicted, then the effect that the prayer is going to have is going to be one that may be uplifting, challenging, affirming, and illuminating. In the case when you're praying with someone who has a demonic condition, it is illuminating, but it's illuminating in not in a way that would seem to affirm the power of the faith of the person, but it would affirm that there is a separate, intelligent, spiritual being that has been threatened sufficiently to be able no longer to hide. And so therefore, and that's what a manifestation is. It's a perversion of the effect of what prayer normally should have. And so when you see the eyes rolling, or you see the person hearing the person speak in a language they've never spoken, or many of these other kinds of behaviors, the falling off the chair, the manipulation of the tongue, a completely separate, intelligent being speaking through the the host of the person who has a soul, and basically taking over the person. That's what I mean by manifestation.
So, you know, in a lot of the movies, I think, you know, most people who, you know, like horror movies, you know, have probably seen at one time or another a movie about someone who's, you know, possession, at the very least The Exorcist and that sort of thing. And obviously, you know, I would probably assume that the vast majority of those are very much, unrealistic in terms of what an actual exorcism looks like. But one of the commonalities, or one of the common themes anyway, that seem to pop up in these types of movies is that, you know, when the demon or, you know, Satan is speaking to the exorcist, it almost sounds like another voice or several voices. Is that something that's actually a real occurrence, or is that something that's just kind of a Hollywood vehicle, if you will?
No, that's accurate.
Wow.
Much of what you see in the movies is very accurate. So when you saw the movie The Rite, And I worked on the scenes involving the pregnant woman who became impregnated by her father in the case of incest. All of those movements, those are all very accurate. Now, the critics panned the movie and said that was unrealistic. But honestly, they are all very ignorant. Those are very accurate because the director kept saying to me, what do you think, what do you think? I mean, I've been physically attacked. Now, I have a team. I never do any of these things alone, ever, ever. And I've warned exorcists about that. You never want to be doing prayers alone, ever. If you have any suspicion that there is any kind of entity attached. Now, I've prayed with people sometimes alone, but there's no entity attached. But where it's been demonstrated that an entity is attached, you do not want to be with the same person in the same room with that person alone. Even having them in confession can be difficult. You know, so what you see in Hollywood, a lot of that is very accurate. And everything in the movie, you know, in terms of the woman and the reactions and the movement and the, you know, the manipulation of the body, that was all very accurate. Because demons can manipulate a physical body, human body, any way they want. They have the power to do that.
So take us through the rite of exorcism. I've got a copy of it here. I've very limited knowledge on the subject beyond a couple of books, to be quite honest. But take people through. You know, it's a series of prayers, obviously, and so kind of set it up for people. Like, what does an exorcism look like? You mentioned there's a team that's with you, and kind of take us through that process.
Well, usually what happens is, you know, we don't always perform the solemn rite of exorcism on a person. We may do what we call prayers or sessions of deliverance, which the difference between a solemn exorcism and a deliverance is that deliverances are sessions in which prayers are addressed to God only. In the solemn rite, you have the authenticated ritual in Latin or in a few languages that the church has approved, but the translation from the Latin to the English, or probably from the Latin to the language of the country, including English, where it's a prescribed order of prayers that are first addressed to God and then addressed to Satan. That's the major difference between a deliverance and a solemn exorcism. In a solemn exorcism, you actually have a ritual book. In a deliverance session, you're addressing God, but the prayers themselves don't necessarily have the official approval of the church. But they're still permitted because they're addressed to God. And as long as they're addressed to God, any priest can actually pray, any person can actually pray deliverance prayers. But if a person has a demonic condition, you really need to be trained to know what you're doing.
So one of the books I remember reading years ago, you may be familiar with it, was by a famous psychiatrist who's now since passed away, Dr. M. Scott Peck, who wrote a book called Glimpses of the Devil. And it was just basically a few case studies that through his career, he felt, you know, he's like, it wasn't this, you know, you know, this mental disorder, it wasn't this mental disorder. And so he, you know, exhausted this list and came to the conclusion that it could be nothing else but true possession. And so he, in the book, he talks about how he seeks the help of an exorcist and learning more about it. And one of the things that he mentions, and I just want to get your opinion on this, is that he felt as if the longer the person had been possessed, the more difficult it was to release them from that bond. Is that your experience as well?
Yes, because the longer the demonic have an opportunity to tie themselves to the person, the more difficult it is to basically cast the demonic out. Because the demonic have two roles. One is parasitic. They're living off our life forms. And they're living off our life forms because they're slowly dying. And they've been slowly dying since the great the great rebellion in heaven. And then the second goal that they have is basically to take as many of us to hell with them as possible, to take as many of the children of God away from God as possible, because they know they've already been defeated. They have no chance, and they know that. That they've known that since the moment Jesus died on the cross and breathed his last breath. From that time on, where Christ's sacrifice, his mission was complete and successful when he died, when he sacrificed himself, that was the one true sacrifice that established a new covenant between the world and the Father by Jesus, and that is what signals Satan's complete defeat, because Jesus, as God and human, is able to offer the one perfect sacrifice. So, up until that time, all the covenants in the Old Testament, they all had been broken over and over and over again, and so that's why God sends the Son, and Jesus becomes incarnate in order to be born, to live, to suffer, to die, and to rise. But it is not at the resurrection, it's at the crucifixion when Satan is defeated. The resurrection is the Father's stamp on the legitimacy of Jesus Christ as the Son of God.
So, go on.
That's right. And so, therefore, those are the two reasons why the demonic continue to try and afflict the human race. One, because they themselves are dying and live off our life forms. So the man I made mention of, who was, you know, in the womb and then was abused at age 2 and felt that there was something hanging on him, but he thought it was an angel. You know, the demons, there's lots of people who probably have demonic afflictions and they don't know it. And they may be sometimes confused with they have a psychological disorder, psychiatric disorder. They may think they have a mental health condition, and they may. And sometimes the cases I have are both mental health and demonic. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're demonic and they're not mental health, and sometimes they are mental health. And you have to sort all that out, because what you don't want to do, you want to relieve the person's suffering, but you need to do it in a way that's going to help the person. And so, you know, you don't want to perform an exorcism on a person who's suffering from a psychotic disorder. You can end up doing a lot of harm rather than any good. And that's why you have a team, you know, and you only go to a solemn exorcism when all other means of liberation have failed. And that takes a judgment on my part, and that's in consultation with a whole bunch of different people.
So, we're running a little low on time here, so I only got a couple more questions for you. But I thought one thing that was interesting that I made note of that in one of the interviews that you had done previously was you mentioned the fact that in the course of an exorcism, when you're addressing the demon or Satan or whatever it is that is possessing the individual, that you address it directly and stick to the facts. Why is that? What is the purpose behind that?
Well, because the demons lie. By their very nature, they're deceptors. And so you state very, very tightly to obtaining the demon's name and the doorway through which they came in and when they're going to leave. And you don't want to get into long conversations out of curiosity. You only ask the questions you have to ask. And they're going to resist as much as they can, because once they give over their name, then they lose their power. And once they give over their name, then they will end up going. It doesn't mean there won't be a battle, but they will go. And they know they've lost. So they'll do everything they can to be as deceptive and cunning and strategic, to do the very opposite things of what I'm trying to do. You know, and it's a battle. And they want to hide because they want you to believe, like Satan has had such a great you know, track record of convincing large swaths of our populace that he doesn't exist. So if he doesn't exist, then you have no optic by which to judge evil. So, like, for example, this is, you know, this is, I think, a very poignant example. All of the chaos, and I'm not talking about the hurricanes and the fires and the earthquake in Mexico, all of the incredible, palpable chaos that is taking place in our world at this time globally. You can talk about Trump's presidency. You can talk about Kim Jong-un. You can talk about ISIS. You can talk about the persecution of Christians around the world. You can talk about the complete confusion of, like, let's talk about gender theory, where all of a sudden we've had this incredible uptake in the number of people who want to change their genders from male to female or female to male, or who think they're transgender. Where did all that come from? I'm not suggesting that people who are struggling with their gender identity are demonic. I'm not at all. What I am suggesting is that there has been a created condition by which people have become very, very confused about these matters. Or in the case of the Congress and the president, where, you know, every day is like we're starting from square A all over again and we don't know what to expect. Or you have a Congress that is completely, for all intents and purposes, you know, impotent to do very much because they're all fighting with each other constantly. That's all spiritual warfare. And, you know, when people use that term, it's really not a... People interpret it as being something that's very kind of fundamentalistic, kind of evangelical, Pentecostal-esque, and it's a very suspicious term. But honestly, it's the most accurate term because all of this chaos that's going on in our culture, and not just here in the States, all over the world, it's largely, it's all in one way or another, it's driven by Satan. Some of it may be at very low levels in terms of how families get along or don't get along. Although I've had families come talk to me about stuff where it's like, there's definitely something here. It's this, 'cause it's so, you can tell the difference between, you know, conflict that's within the realm of the normal and conflict that's outside the realm of the normal, because what's outside the realm of the normal seems to make absolutely no sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
So, for example, 9/11, which got today's the anniversary, the 16th anniversary. I wasn't the exorcist in those days, but I preached in my parish the weekend after 9/11 on the diabolical event that we called the Twin Towers. That just didn't happen. That was not just premeditated. That was of such a deeply evil, palpably evil, and immeasurably evil event that had all the trappings of something that was meant to be so far outside the reasonable understanding of most human beings, that the intended carnage was supposed to create such an environment of terror that human beings couldn't get their hands around, their heads around. That was a diabolical event. I have no doubt in my mind. Wow. When Columbine took place in 1999, the two young men who were responsible for all of those two young men were involved in the occult. There was an occult altar in the home of one of those kids. And that's why I preached on that as a demonic event, because those kids were involved in Satanism.
Man.
So, you know, and it's becoming more part of our culture. You know, if you were, where in the East Coast are you?
We're more in the Midwest. We're in the middle of Ohio, so Columbus, Ohio.
Okay. Google in metaphysical shops or botanicas and see how many of these little places of business show up in Columbus or in the surrounding areas. this stuff's becoming very, very mainstream now. And it's becoming very mainstream because it's becoming more acceptable. And what's making it acceptable is that large numbers of people are leaving Christianity specifically. But they're still seeking, because we're all spiritual beings. What makes us spiritual beings, we all have a soul. That people are still seeking answers to questions. They're unfortunately now seeking them down the wrong streets. And the streets and the avenues they're seeking them down is toward paganism and sorcery and magic. And that's why we have more and more people who are in big, big trouble. You know, this is very true in Hollywood. You know, in Hollywood, there are certain entertainers, actresses, who've been very open about their relationship with the spirit world. Beyonce being one, Jim Carrey, who's a poor example of a comedian, being another, but there are many. I don't know enough about Scientology to be able to make an intelligent judgment about Scientology, but Scientology is a very secret religion. Why is that? Why is it so secretive? You know, so, and there's really no God. It's really more of a cult than it is a religion, because there is no God in their system. It's L. Ron Hubbard. So you have a lot of, you know, an Eastern spirituality. For example, in Buddhism, they have demons. In Hinduism, they have demons. And Hinduism is all, it's multi-theist. It's polytheism. They have a multitude of gods in Hinduism. In Buddhism, Buddhism is godless, period. There is no God. We become the God. And we become the God when we ourselves are absorbed into nature. And it's our destruction, so to speak, is when we become, in a sense, kind of the God. It flies in the face of anything where there's any understanding of a supreme being. Now, that does not mean that any person who's a Buddhist is satanic. That when people choose to go and find, let's say, the word enlightenment in some of these places, in some of these structures, that sometimes they're also going to end up finding stuff that they're not expecting.
So I think the important thing to end on then is in your professional opinion, what are some ways that people can protect themselves from this realm?
Well, there are four ordinary means of protection. I've given talks specifically on what you're asking. There's four ordinary means. There's a faith life. In other words, I have an optic in which I judge that there is a supreme being bigger than me, and I would want to stress supreme being because there's lots of people who are quote-unquote spiritual, but when you ask what they really mean, they don't really know. And also, there are people who really know what they mean by spiritual. It has nothing to do with anything Christian. It has to do with New Age, the occult, Reiki, yoga, used for purposes of enlightenment as opposed to purposes of exercise, and that's a very different modality to use yoga. When people are using yoga for purposes of power, intelligence, and awareness, they're opening doors. Because there is a God, there is actually a God attached to every single movement in yoga. And so the faith life, I have a relationship with God. And in that relationship with God, I acknowledge that there is a supreme being, an intelligent being, who's responsible for my creation, redemption, and sanctification. Then I have a prayer life. That means that I spend time in a relationship with God. And I have a moral life. It means that my compass of how I live my life has clarity to it based on a set of moral principles and precepts in which I try basically and do good and avoid evil. You know, in the most basic sense of the word, and without putting too much Christianity attached to it, in a Christian optic, it would be, you know, how do I live the two great commandments and follow the Ten Commandments. And then out of that, for Catholic, it would be, how do I fortify myself in the relationship I have with God, in the intention of building a personal relationship with God and living an ordered life? I have a sacramental system, namely the Eucharist, what we would say would be our Mass and confession, and Mass weekly, Eucharist weekly, confession monthly, prayer daily. You know, you follow those four precepts, for a Catholic at least, the chances of anything happening are very nil. For a Christian, it would be the first three, you know, a prayer life, a faith life, and a moral life. For a non-Christian, it would be basically, how do I live my life in terms of how do I conduct myself? Do I, even if I don't necessarily embrace Christianity, what we teach in the Catholic Church is what's called baptism by desire. So a person who may, for whatever reason, not be a baptized individual, it does not mean that heaven is not possible. It means that have I lived my life in the breath of the will of God? You know, if I've met people who have never been baptized, but, you know, were raised by parents who had a very strong ethic, moral ethic. Well, that matters, and that counts. And they may not necessarily have put a God label to the way they've behaved or lived, but they have lived in the spirit of what God's will would be for them, as far as, you know, how do I choose to do good and avoid evil? But you follow those four precepts that I just mentioned. That's how you basically, those are the four means of protection.
Wow, well, Adam and I just want to thank you so much for, I know we had to reschedule here and everything, so we want to thank you for taking the time out of your schedule to share some of this stuff with us. This is absolutely fascinating, and something that Adam and I don't know a ton about, so we wanted to get the expert on. So thank you so much. Before we let you go, though, so where can people go to get the book about your life? And if people are in need, what's the best way to get in contact with you?
Well, the best way to get the book would be most likely through Amazon. I'm not sure if I'm sure there must be still copies of the book in soft copy. You probably could get it through Amazon without any problem whatsoever. I doubt very much if bookstores. Although bookstores are becoming kind of rare now, I doubt very much if bookstores would still carry the book about me. They did for a number of years, but I think Amazon for sure would. So that would be the best place to get the book. The book's an easy read, and it's very, very well done. Matt Balio researched that book very, very well. It's written in a kind of a novel-like form, but it's really written kind of as a textbook. So it has a lot of information in there, but it's a very, very good read. And it's very informative. And for a topic that can be very heavy, I think he was very successful at a good balance. As far as reaching me is concerned, in general, what we try and do is redirect people back to their own diocese unless they're local. So they can, best way would most likely be to Google my name.
Perfect. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. We really appreciate your time, and we just appreciate the work that you're doing and educating us a little bit. And like I said, an area that we don't just, especially as Protestants, don't know a ton about. So we really appreciate it.
Well, you're most welcome. And I was very glad to do the interview with you. And I hope you found this informative, and I hope your listeners will as well.
Thank you very much. Have a great night.
Bye. God bless. And thank you again. Every single week. And I gave you my money so that you would tell me what to think. And I learned from a book that you had taken the heart out of. And that's how I learned to make exclusion. Taking me to
So come, come as you are. Take up your cross. Use it to build a wall. And reach across the aisle. And fire your guns. So you can keep them. And love, love how you want. If we approve, and you'll be undefiled. So come, accept our gift, salvation from sinners. Taking me too long to recover. I go feed the sick and poor and try to help the world to recover. I won't do it anymore. It's taking me too long. Take a while to wade through the fear and the hurt, but I think there's a way for us to love and heal the world.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.